Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820 brings you Foundations in Faith. Join Monsignor Frank Lane as he offers insights into the readings heard at Mass. And now, Foundations in Faith with Monsignor Frank Lane.
This is Father Frank Lane, and we're continuing our program, Foundations in Faith. Today, we're going to look at the Holy Gospel according to St. Mark, the 13th chapter, the 24th and 32nd verse. We're getting now to the end of Jesus' active life, again to the end of his proclamation. And what he's beginning to talk about now is something that we call the eschaton, the parousia. It is basically talking about the end of time. It's a very interesting text that we have, because this is one of the things that remains an anchor and a mainstay in the whole biblical tradition. And that is, what exactly is this apocalyptic language and this apocalyptic literature all about? And we find now in Mark's Gospel, when he begins to talk about the end, that he's using some of the terminology that has a real repetitive presence within sacred scripture, especially also within the Old Testament and the apocalyptic literature of the Old Testament. But first, let's hear what he has to say. Jesus said to his disciples, "In those days, after the time of distress, the sun will be darkened, the moon will lose its brightness, and the stars will come falling from heaven, and the powers in the heaven will be shaken. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory. Then too he will send the angels to gather his chosen from the four winds and the ends of the world from the ends of the world to the ends of heaven." He goes on again, but so far let us stay just simply with that particular insight, that particular proclamation. First of all, he's using the kind of prophetic and poetic language of apocalyptic literature, borrowing from Isaiah, from Ezekiel, from Daniel, Joel, Habakkuk, so forth. All of those places in the Old Testament where it begins to talk in apocalyptic terms. Of course, in the New Testament, the apocalyptic language takes root, takes form and shape in the book of Revelation. And in the book of Revelation, then we find an abundance of this kind of poetic, prophetic language. But what exactly is this kind of literature? What is it all about? Well, it comes to be about the coming of the Lord and the ending of this world as we know it. And so it is very deeply related to the whole notion, the whole biblical understanding of the notion of time. And part of where we get ourselves into a difficulty and into a problem with this is that we remove ourselves from the biblical notion of time, and we've certainly talked about this before, and we begin to use time simply as a measurement of duration, and not as some kind of existent reality that is part and parcel of the created order. For instance, if we were to try to think in terms of infinity or in terms of some kind of endlessness, we always kind of, in our minds and in our culture and in our language, we always kind of push this then into our understanding of measurement. And it's impossible for us to measure infinity. And so when we talk about eternity or infinity, it seems to us mind-boggling and incomprehensible. But in the Bible, in the scriptures themselves, and in Revelation, time is not an endless measurement of duration. Time is something that is part of the created order, and that eternity is not an endless duration of measurable moments, but eternity is an eternally now moment, an eternally present moment, that it is not something that stretches out throughout the universe, something that simply is and always is. This sounds abstract to us, and it sounds difficult for us. But so too do we have to speak of this, or when we get into apocalyptic language, we fail to understand it. And what happens is that we begin to see prophecy, and we begin to see the eschatological language, which means the end of time language of the scriptures, as some kind of vision into the future. And so it becomes kind of a strange arena for people to prowl around in, and to use their imagination to conjure up all sorts of prophetic images, prophetic in the sense of being soothsayers. For instance, they can say, well, you know, who is the beast and what is the beast and when is the time of the beast? And there is not a generation that has lived that has not been able in some way, shape, or form to identify some kind of presence within their own time and place that could be identified with the beast, with the beast of the apocalypse. But that's not what apocalyptic literature is all about. It's not about Mao Zedong. It's not about Joseph Stalin. It's not about Adolf Hitler. It's not about whoever our particular enemies might be in the present age. That's not what it's all about. It is always, in a way, about the present. And it is always, in a way, in time, incorporating both the present and the future and even the past. This is hard for us. You know, in the Old Testament, for instance, there is we live in the past through word and through ritual. The whole idea of word and ritual in the Old Testament and in the New Testament is that we encounter an event that exists in the past, not that existed in the past, but in the biblical notion of time that exists in the past and is accessible to us through word and ritual to where we become present to the events of our deliverance. That's true of the Passover, that's true of the Feast of First Fruits, and actually that's also true of the whole structure of the Eucharistic story in the narratives of the institution of the sacrament by Jesus himself. They did not deny the existence of the future in this being time, but they were very clear that we may not enter into that, nor may we try and get in touch with that, because that, in a way, was somehow or other an arena that belonged to God alone. That's what happened, for instance, when Saul went to see the witch of Endor to conjure up the prophet Samuel to tell him what to do. It wasn't that he couldn't do it. He did. The witch did conjure up of Samuel, the prophet Samuel. But Saul died because he had violated that most sacred principle that you leave the future to the divine. Although it is already present in time, and this is part of the whole trial and the whole struggle with the idea of grace in the 17th century, that how do we have free will if God knows the future? Well, the fact of the matter is the future already is in this being time. It is just, and we have already then in our own way created it in how we have lived, but it is not accessible to us because it is in the realm of the divine. And it is basically leaves us absolutely free to make the decisions that we make because we have already in some way participated in the final result of those decisions. So that the idea, when you even take the notion of grace and you stuff that into a rational linear measurement of duration as time, then you have an absolute impossible dilemma, and one that was impossible and unable to be determined by the great theologians of the age and caused a great deal of consternation, a great deal of difficulty. So, what is Jesus talking about in this gospel according to St. Mark? Well, what he might be talking about is, in fact, the destruction of Jerusalem. It is to occur less than 40 years after his death. We don't know, and this brings another great theological problem into perspective. What did Jesus know as a human being? What did he know as a man? No one knows for sure what that is. We know that there are certainly glimpses within Jesus of his whole destiny, of his whole personhood. We see that very clearly in Luke's gospel of the finding of the child in the temple. And we see it here as well. And yet, it's interesting. He can understand and know that Jerusalem is going to be destroyed and the temple is going to be destroyed, and that is going to be a great apocalyptic event for the Jews. And it happens in 70 AD. But he also knows that it is kind of the story of the things that we create, the things that we build ourselves, that everything that humanity does has an end. And it doesn't matter whether it's monuments or whether it's structures of government or whether it's economic systems or whatever it is, it has an end. And those ends are always seen as great apocalyptic moments. When we look at the book of Revelation, for instance, the book of Revelation, I think Scott Hahn has a book that about that is being kind of simply a look at the real structure of the Eucharist, a real structure of the Mass. And I must admit, I haven't really pursued that and looked into that, but I've heard that, and it certainly is a possibility, as you know, in this whole notion of what apocalyptic literature really is. And here, too, he may well be talking about the end of the temple, the end of Jerusalem. We don't know. But then he says this, "But take the fig tree as a parable. As soon as its twigs grow supple and its leaves come out, you know that summer is near. So with you, when you see these things happening, you know that he is near at the very gates. I tell you solemnly, before this generation has passed away, all these things will have taken place." Isn't that interesting? Before this generation passes away, all these things will have taken place. So that is he delusional? Does he think that he will die and return? Does he think that the Isaiah day of the Lord will happen within the lifetime of those people present? Is that what he's saying? Or is he saying the apocalyptic event, which you can see happening, which you can see on the way? Anyone who is an astute observer of persons, of politics, of institutions, can simply see that this whole situation with Jerusalem is untenable in the ancient world. And so are those the signs that Jesus is talking about? Is he in fact talking about the end of the temple? Is he talking about the end of the city? Is that what's happening? And if so, is he reading the signs of the times as someone with great insight, great wisdom, and great knowledge? But then he goes on from that, and we don't know that for sure, but then he goes on and said, "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away." There, very clearly, he refers to the absolute end of time. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away, because they are the word of the living God. "But as for that day or hour, nobody knows it, neither the angels of heaven nor the Son, no one but the Father." And so Jesus, as the human, admits the limitations of his knowledge of the distant future. And because of his divinity being encased within humanity, there is obviously something of a lack of the full human knowledge. That, and yet at the same time, there is an understanding that all things will return to the Creator, will return to the source from which they came. So there are two dimensions of eschatology in this gospel. The one dimension of eschatology is a historical dimension of eschatology, where he might well be, in fact, telling about, from reading the signs of the times, it is very clear that the temple's days are limited, that Jerusalem is a great city, is limited, its time is limited in this experience of time and history within the created order. But then he goes on to acknowledge that there is also a termination to that which has been created, that creation is not forever. And this is a very interesting dispute and a very interesting discussion, because at the University of Paris in the 13th century, there was a huge debate between Bonaventure and Thomas Aquinas, involving also Henry of Ghent and I think Cesar of Brabant as well, and about Aristotle's proposition that it is a logical, rational probability that the earth is eternal. Now, this becomes problematic when time is a measurement of duration. And these are going to be some of the arguments that are used against Aristotle. But Thomas says that it is reasonable to presume that the earth is going to be eternal. But from faith, we know that that's not true. And so he corrects the logical proposition with the instruments of faith. Bonaventure, on the other hand, says that it is not logical to argue or rational to argue that the world will be eternal, because we already know that it isn't. And how can you say something is reasonable when you know that it's not true before you even begin to use your reason to come to the conclusion? And he goes on then to use, in a semi-fallacious sort of way, I suppose, from modern science, he goes on to then discuss the idea that you cannot determine infinite numbers, and you would have to be able to calculate infinite numbers if you were to calculate the eternity of the world in a rational structure. He also took the old idea that there was a set amount of human beings who God was going to create in the course of the created order. And that, so when that reached its limit, then he says if you had an eternal word, you would have to begin to have the reincarnation in order not to exceed the fixed number of human beings that God had intended from all eternity to create. So it becomes, in a way, a mathematical problem in the final analysis, and basically using the notion of time as a measurement of duration. So that there is then this great debate going on about how do we deal with the problem of time? How do we deal with what the created order really is? And we find that within this sacred scripture, the created order is not eternal, and that means that time is not eternal, for it is an element of the created order. And when the created order passes away, time also passes away, and we have what we call the eternal now. However, this idea that there is a future that is unknown to us, a future toward which we are drawn, a future where our own destiny is written for all eternity, a time when the Lord himself will come, and when, in fact, his word will not pass away, but will survive the termination of the created order. The idea for the Christian, then, is, what does it mean to live in a world that we know has an end? And what does it mean to be believers in a time, in a world that extends beyond time into the eternal now? And where will we be? How will we exist? We are assured that we are going to exist as persons. We are assured that there is the resurrection of the body. We are assured that this composite person of body and soul that we are has an eternal destiny. We also know that at the time of that meek encounter with the eternal destiny, we also understand and know that whatever, wherever we are, whatever it is then eternally the now. There is no past then. There is no future then. There is only now then. And that is our ultimate destiny, the ultimate disposition of our lives. When Christianity avoids these issues, the issues whether it was for Jerusalem to avoid the concept of the destruction of the temple, if that is what Jesus was talking about, or whether we are talking about the end of the world, there is an end in sight for the believer. And who are we? when that end comes upon us. This is a crucial, critical element of faith. Without the sense of a destiny, without the sense of a future, without the sense of an eternal now in which we will be present, then Christianity becomes, in a sense, simply kind of a local, ethical, moral system of any kind of structured society. Without the notion that God returns and reclaims his creation, then the whole idea of the mystery of faith, the whole idea of salvation, the whole idea of somehow or other the purpose of the Christian life fades into the fads and into the structures and into the ideologies of the present age. And so what happens then is we try and we make every effort to kind of make our faith simply a matter of practice and not a matter of mystery, of destiny, of hope. And when we do that, it loses something of itself. It loses the core of its very reason to be. There's many ways to make people be nice to each other. You can do it by force. You can do it any way you want to. You can do it with control, with manipulation. You can do it with all sorts of things. Usually it has the opposite effect, as in the contemporary world, where the media has decided that they have established now a moral and ethical norm for public life. That moral and ethical norm contains all sorts of self-destructive elements. But because it is ideologically locked in, the facts of its destructive capabilities does not in any way alter the vision that they have created and the dream, the non-world that they have conceived of in their minds and impose upon the society that they manipulate and control. That's not heaven, and that's not Christianity, and that's not the word that comes to us from the living God. That speaks not to the manipulation of the external person or the indoctrination of the internal person. It comes from a response of love for the source of our being. In that is our freedom, and in that is the truth of our soul, and in that is the only real future destiny of the human race. When in fact we create ourselves as the divine beings, as the creators of human persons, as the creators of culture, of society, of intelligence, of wisdom, all of that, we are preparing ourselves for the destruction of the temple. This is exactly the sin of the Pharisees and the scribes. They usurped the secret, the mystery of the covenant, and they turned it into praxis, and praxis alone. There was no interest, really, in the mysterious living God, but there was an obsession with how the person went about acknowledging that the living God, whom they did not worship anymore, because they had simply become functionaries within the Pharisaical society of the first century. We have run into the same problem in the modern age as well. Rather than stand in awe of the mystery of the divine, we have somehow or other taken this religion of ours and turned it into praxis so that we ourselves stay in control of the mystery of this life in our world. It's not really something that will last a very long time. It has no foundation. It is unreal. It has no soul to it. It has no core to it, which transcends and is beyond the manipulators. And the result of it is that the apocalyptic vision of the scriptures somehow or other then begins to interpret this foolishness of humanity and begins to warn us that it, in fact, will be destroyed or destroy itself. For in those days, after the time of this great distress, the sun will be darkened, the moon will lose its brightness, the stars will come falling from heaven, and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory. Then, too, he will send the angels to gather his chosen from the four winds, from the ends of the world to the ends of heaven. When, in fact, the prison of praxis is destroyed by the grace of God, then we will see the glory of the Lord. Then we will see, for instance, if Jesus is talking about the destruction of the temple, it is at this time that very definitively Christianity ceases to be a sect, a Jewish sect, and becomes then in the four corners of the earth, with the dispersion of the apostolic preaching and teaching, it becomes then the people of God from all that covers the whole earth. If Thomas went to India, if James went to Spain, and so forth, then the known world was filled with the presence of Christ, with the liturgy of the Christ, with the sacramental reality of the presence of the Christ. And so the great liberation, and this is part of some of the explanation and some of the scholarly debate about the meaning of this text, it could well be the destruction of the temple and the liberation of the church to where it lives now on its own, sacramentally and in the Word, as the people of God related to the mysterious God through the person, through the man, Jesus, into the person of the Son of God, and into, therefore, the person of the Trinitarian God. So that these are not able to be clearly explained, and these are not able to be clearly understood, but basic concepts have to accompany us. One, that time is a created entity, coextensive with the created order, and that before creation it did not exist, and after creation it will not exist. It is not a rational linear measurement of the duration of our lives. It is an entity in which we live. Secondly, that the apocalyptic literature usually addresses something imminent or something in the present experience of the covenanted people, something that brings about a tremendous change, a destruction of an inadequate old order, and the coming to be of a new relationship with God. And if that's what this is all about, then that also is what our faith is all about. And woe to us if we trivialize it, if we ourselves decide that it is simply a movement that we can control and manipulate, if it is, in fact, something self-serving and not something that looks beyond into eternity, into the mystery of the living God, of the Creator God.
Foundations in Faith is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of Foundations in Faith are available at stgabrielradio.com.